Mondesi, deep center field. Buxton on the run. It's off the wall. Buxton is down. How far will he go? Mike Churchill, he's going to wave him. Mondesi to the plate with an inside the park home run.
The exciting part of Tuesday night's game between the Royals and the Twins is Kansas City back on the field after having Monday off. But in the end, the bullpen woes kind of continuing for the Royals as they end up falling 5-4 in extras in 10 innings to the Twins, dropping to 2-2 as the Twins improve to 3-1. Well, much more coming up on the Royals game against the Twins last night. We also take a look at local sports here just momentarily. Also, some coaching news in the college ranks, where not only Fred Hoiberg introduced by Nebraska, but coming out this morning, a couple interesting coaching nuggets to pass along from NCAA men's basketball. And then also we'll take a look at the Wichita State Shockers finishing up play in the NIT and another spring football league that is not going to continue on and fails for maybe different reasons than what maybe other spring football leagues have failed. But we'll talk about that coming up here in the sports ticket. But before we do any of that, we want to get you an update on local sports. There was a lot of activity yesterday in our area, and we'll start first with the St. John's Track and Field Invitational, and there was a load of talent and a lot of great results and finishes for our area athletes there yesterday at the St. John's Track and Field Invitational at the track at Beloit High. So we'll tell you the gold medal winners from the area. Again, full results are posted at nckssports.com. On the girls' side, the team champion was Bennington with 131 points. Lakeside finished second with 79. Osborne third, St. John's fourth, and Lincoln was fifth. And then on the boys' side, St. John's took the team title with 116 points. Osborne second with 110.5. Lakeside was third. Sylvan Lucas fourth, and Thunder Ridge in fifth place. Gold medals for Afton Conway of Osborne in the 100-meter dash, the open 100, also the 100-meter hurdles, and the 300-meter hurdles for Conway. Aubrey Donnelly of Lincoln took first place in the 400-meter dash. Jaden Bowden of Thunder Ridge was first in the 800. J.C. Vance of Lincoln won both the 1,600 and 3,200-meter runs. 4x800-meter relay team for Lincoln of Aubrey Donnelly, Shelby Ford, Sarah McMahon, and Reagan Stewart took first place. Morass Donfer of Thunder Ridge winning the high jump. Janica Pierce of Lakeside the long jump. Al Eilert from St. John's wins the triple jump. Ryan Brown, two gold medals for Osborne in the shot put and javelin. And Kara Eilert of St. John's taking the discus gold medal. And on the boys' side of things, gold medal winners, Mason Schur of Osborne, the 400-meter dash. Reagan Bales won the 800 and 1,600-meter runs for the Bulldogs. Caleb Eilert winning the 3,200-meter run for St. John's. Darian Holloway first place in both the 110 and 300-meter hurdles. 4x100-meter relay team for Osborne from Mason Schur, Darian Holloway, Rylan Klein-Hackert, and also Darnell Holloway finishing in first place. The 4x1, 4x4 team for Thunder Ridge, Cameron Groundholtz, Brandon Groundholtz, Landon Gearing, and Reese Struckoff in first place. 4x800-meter relay team for St. John's, Brandon Bates, Cale Dubert, Caleb Eilert, and Braden Perez in first place. Also, Brady Pullen tied the school record in the high jump. He ties Davis Dubert with a jump of 6 feet 7 inches on that school record list and took the gold in the high jump there on Tuesday in Beloit. Pullen also winning the long jump gold medal. Wyatt Eberle of Lakeside won the triple jump. Jordan Wary of Osborne, both the shot put and discus golds. And Caleb Hake of Lakeside winning the javelin gold medal. It would take me a very long time to go through all the success that our area athletes had yesterday at the St. John's Invitational. Again, the full results can be found at nckssports.com. Also on Tuesday, the Smith Center Golf Invitational was held. Phillipsburg took first place as a team with a 341 score. Osborne was second at 382. Smith Center finished in fifth place. Area top 10 finishes. Tyler Martin of Phillipsburg was first place overall, shooting a 77. Austin Hobelman of Smith Center fourth. Lath Watkins of Osborne finished in sixth place. Steele Walters was seventh. Brandon Beffert ninth. And Grady Walters 10th. All those last four competing for Osborne in the meet there on Tuesday. Also, full results for the Smith Center Golf Invitational are at nckssports.com. And wrapping up local sports, baseball and softball yesterday from our area, where the Beloit Lady Trojans improved to 4-0 on the season, picking up a sweep in the NCAA over Minneapolis, winning 14-1 in five innings in the first game. Darby Odell got the win, and Breezy Schroeder and Odell each had three RBI in the win. Also, Beloit wins the second game 16-3. Madeline Johnson, the winning pitcher for the Lady Trojans in the second game. Carson Brown, Jenna Loomis each had three RBI for Beloit in that one. As again, they're now 4-0 on the season. unfortunately for the Beloit baseball team, they've dropped to 0-6, a couple tough losses. They're a very young team and trying to get experience as the season goes on. Minneapolis won the first game 5-1 and took game 2 13-3 over Beloit. So the Trojans fall in both of those. They'll come back home coming up here later this week in baseball and softball. Coming up on Thursday, we'll continue to keep you up to date on all that as it goes on throughout the season. So that's a look at local sports again. And always for the latest local sports, you can check out ncksports.com. Well, we'll start with the Royals here. Again, you heard at the start of the sportscast where Adalberto Mondesi had the inside the park home run. It was interesting when I was watching, I can't remember if it was the first game or the second game, but anyway, they interviewed Mondesi after the game on the TV broadcast, and he said, you know, at some point, he had two triples in the first game, was on pace for over 300 triples. Obviously, we knew that was going to slow down, but he said eventually in that interview, in the post game, that was opening day, and he's like, eventually, I'm gonna get them all. I'm going to get every bag on one of these hits. And he hit that rocket shot to center field, and Buxton jumped up and ended up hitting the wall, and I was like, that ball started just floating away from him. Yep, this is it. This is where it's going to happen. And it did. A very exciting play where Adalberto Mondesi gave the Royals a 4-3 lead. But the story of the game and the story so far early this season, even though the Royals are 2-2, has been the struggling of the bullpen. And last night, they got out to a 1-0 and took two pitches, and they were up 1-0. Whit Merrifield extended his hitting streak to 24 games. On the first pitch of the game, he hit a double off of Berrios, the starter for the Twins. So he hit the double. Two pitches in, you have a run and a guy on base here. So you're feeling pretty good as Mondesi ended up driving in Whit Merrifield, and then Mondesi ended up stealing second base. So you've got a guy on second with nobody out and a run in already. But then Berrios kind of reeled everything in there against the Royals, and they ended up getting just the one run in that inning. The Twins tied it up at 1-4, and then the Royals get another one in the fourth, bottom of the fourth, to take a 2-1 lead. But a fifth inning, two-run inning for Minnesota made it 3-2 in favor of the Twins. And then, finally, the Royals went deep.
O'Hearn gets on top of one, and we are tied right up the steps. His first home run of the season.
So first home run of the season there for Ryan O'Hearn as the Royals tied the game at 3 there, and then Mondesi had the inside-the-park homer to give the Royals a 4-3 lead in the eighth inning. Things are looking good, right? Well, here's the thing. Earlier there in the seventh inning, the Twins had loaded the bases. They got two hits off of relief pitcher Tim Hill, who came in. And then right after that, a walk by Willie Peralta loaded the bases. But from there, Peralta kind of calmed down. He got out of a bases loaded, no out jam there in the seventh inning to keep the game tied at 3. Diekman came in and got a 1-2-3 inning, didn't allow any walks or hits there in the eighth. And feeling pretty good going into the ninth. Ian Kennedy had done some decent things out of the bullpen so far early this year already, but was not so good last night. He allowed three hits and gave up a run, an earned run. And that gave the lead to the Twins 5-4. And that tied the game, I should say, at 4, the blown save for Ian Kennedy. And then in the 10th inning, everything was looking okay. I mean, it wasn't great. Boxberger had allowed guys to get on. There's a runner at third. And a ground ball by the Twins DH Nelson Cruz. Fielded at third base by Dozier. And he steps on the third base bag to get the force out, as the bases were actually loaded at the point. So he steps on the bag to get the force out at third. Inning's over, right? We're tied at 4. We're going into the top of the 11th inning. And not so fast. Umpire from third base is overruled by the home plate umpire. Says the ball actually went foul down the line that Hunter Dozier caught and then tagged on third base to get the out. Home plate umpire told Ned Yost that the third base umpire was blocked, so he couldn't see it. So that's why he made the call and overruled the third base umpire, who was closer to the play, overruled that decision by the third base umpire, and then went with his decision of foul ball, put them back where they're at, everybody back on base, and then a single by Nelson Cruz that beats the shift, ends up scoring a run to make it 5-4 Twins. we would have been headed to the bottom of the 10th there, not the 11th. But then they go to the bottom of the 10th, and the Royals can't get anything going on the closer for the Twins. Blake Parker, who ended up finishing things off there, did walk one, but ended up getting out of that, and the Royals did not score in the bottom of the 10th inning. So the Twins won it 5-4. So a little bit of controversy there at the end of the game, but I tell you, this the bullpen is something that obviously was an issue last year as we went on and started going toward the end of the year and kind of knowing that as the season progressed, it continued to be a bit of an issue, the bullpen. And of course, when you're so used to having a bullpen that's outstanding like you had when you won the World Series in 2015 and then the year before that, 14, an outstanding bullpen as well. Excuse me, you're obviously... It's going to be hard to live up to what they did during that stretch, but at times the bullpen is just not where it needs to be. Now, at times the bullpen does some good things, like Willie Peralta last night where he's in a jam and Tim Hill comes in, allows a couple hits to Ron, then a walk by Peralta to start his outing, and then he reels it in, gets three outs, gets out of a bases-loaded jam and a 3-3 tie, keeps the game tied, and then Mondesi comes in and gets the inside the park home run. The Royals are right back up 4-3, feeling all right with Diekman, who comes in and, like I said, gets a 1-2-3 inning, doesn't allow anything, just 12 pitches for Diekman, and got a strikeout, and you're feeling pretty good about it. And then, like I said, Ian Kennedy comes in and then blows the save, and then Boxberger, who had a save earlier this year, then allows a couple hits and a walk and gets the bases loaded, and then Cruz gets the hit with the run and the RBI, and that's that. So it can go from being so good at times to being so bad. And what people remember about the bullpen would be the bad things that happened, the blown save, the loss, the blown save by Kennedy, the loss for Boxberger. But they kind of, you tend to forget about the good things that would happen with the bullpen. And Ned Yost, the manager of the Royals, is saying, well, don't forget about all the good stuff that happened. It just kind of didn't end up going our way. And we'll talk a little bit about that, a little bit more about it hereafter we hear from Ned.
Well, we found the right matchups for the most part. You know, Timmy did a nice job of coming in. It was a good situation for him. It was a good matchup for him. You know, a high hopper and a bunt. You know, Willie came in a crucial situation, a high leverage situation in the seventh inning, like a closer would in the ninth, and did exactly what we wanted him to do. Diekman the same way. Ian ended up making one mistake and almost pitched around it, but ended up giving up the tying run, and then Boxberger ends up giving up a blooper, a walk, and then another little, you know, kind of beat the shift single to lose the ball game. So, they didn't batter him around any stretch of the imagination. So, it continues, it will continue to define itself. But, you know, I was pleased with Willie tonight. I was pleased with Jake, you know, with Diekman, and I just thought the bullpen came in and did a nice job.
So, you know, and he's not wrong. It sounds crazy when he says, I thought the bullpen came in and did a nice job. Well, some members of the bullpen did come in and do a nice job. Whether you're getting dinked or beating the shift or whatever's happening, you're still giving up those hits. You're still giving up runs. You're blowing saves. You're losing games if you're Ian Kennedy and Brad Boxberger. So, I mean, I get – and Ned's not going to be one that's going to talk bad about his team, and especially early in the year when he's trying to build confidence in what they have in that bullpen. I mean, this is – typical Ned Yost. It's try to build these guys up and not tear them down and make them feel worse about what's happened. But listen, there's obviously issues. I mean, the first game, it's a 5-0 game, and you're feeling pretty good about getting the win, and all of a sudden the White Sox are right back in it with the game tiring run at the plate, and you have a chance to lose that one after Brad Keller has a great outing. Now, last night Brad Keller wasn't at the top of his game. He pitched 6 innings, gave up 5 hits, 3 earned runs, and walked 4. So he only struck out 5 and threw 101 pitches in 6 innings. So, you know, that wasn't his best game. His ERA is now 2.08 after it was 0 after the first game, giving up no runs on 2 hits and 7 innings the first time out. It's a quality start. Even though all that happened, it was still deemed a quality start for Brad Keller last night. And you're up 4-3. Another no decision here now for Brad Keller on that one. So that doesn't go as a win or a loss on his record, but you know, obviously he wasn't at his best, but you're still up 4-3 and have a chance to win it. I think the biggest issue right now I have with the Royals is, you know, you don't have to have a set destined closer. You don't have to have a guy that is the one guy that's going to come in and close. Now, I think if you want to have success and you want to win games, you've got to start establishing those roles, and somebody's got to be that guy that you can have lock him down at the end and be the one to do it. Now, Willie Peralta was that guy at the end of the year last year, but there's new guys that have come in, and obviously with Ian Kennedy going from the rotation to the bullpen, that changes a little bit of what they think about and what they might do there, whether they want Kennedy to be the closer or not. You'll find out. The second game of the year, they're up on the White Sox as well and had a decent lead, and the White Sox get within two again on that bullpen. And like I say, it's not every member of the bullpen. Some guys come in and do a good job one night, and they're not going to do the same thing the next night. So they need consistency is what we're talking about, and that's something that they just had all the time when they had Wade Davis, when they had Greg Holland, when they had Kelvin Herrera, when they had the HDH, or when they had Hochaver at times coming out of the pen. He was pretty consistent there during that World Series run as well. And so you had guys that could come in that you felt real comfortable with, and knowing that they're going to come in and do their job night in and night out. You don't have to worry about it. And Ned Yost didn't have to manage as much as he does now and try to figure out who's the right guy to bring in the seventh. You knew it was Herrera. Who's the right guy to bring in the eighth? You knew it was Davis. Who's the right guy to bring in the ninth? You knew it was Holland that first year in 2014. Well, then you know it's Herrera in the eighth and Davis in the ninth. He's going to close the game out for you. You know that those guys are going to come in and do their job. And more often than not, they're going to be consistent. And more often than not, they're not going to blow a save. They're going to get the innings and the outs you need to finish things off, and you're going to move on victorious. Right now, you don't have that. You don't have a guy that you know is going to come in and be that closer and be that guy for the Royals. Like I said, Willie Peralta was that guy toward the end of the year last year. He had 14 saves and 14 opportunities a year ago. So you feel like maybe coming in that he's the guy. But then the first game of the season, he goes out there and gives up a hit and two earned runs and a walk and a hit, two earned runs, and now you're thinking, well, is he the guy or is he not the guy? That comes in with a 5-0 lead and does that. So you don't even have the consistency that you would like that you saw with Willie Peralta, 14 saves and 14 opportunities last year. So that's going to be the biggest issue that I'm going to be looking for with the Royals as the season comes along, because they have shown at times the ability to do things offensively. Adalberto Mondesi is outstanding to start this season. He's hitting .412 early, went 3-for-5 again yesterday with the inside-the-park homer, had the RBI early in the game on the second hit of the game. He drove in Whit Merrifield. He's playing outstanding to start the season. His slug is .941 right now, on-base percentage .412 and average .412. So he's not walking, but when you're seeing a ball like he is, you don't need to walk. When you're hitting .412, walks don't really mean a whole lot. And if you're hitting for power, if you're hitting for a lot of bags, which he's hit for triples, he's hit for the inside-the-park home run. So they've got guys that can do it. Now, they're not consistent, and Jorge Soler went 0-for-5 last night, but his average is still .313. He's had a decent start to the season. Alex Gordon, kind of back to Alex Gordon, he's 0-9-1. He's scored a lot of runs, but hasn't gotten a lot of hits. He's more gotten on base with walks or hit by pitch. Things of that nature for Alex. He can get on base. His on-base percentage, I don't know if I've ever seen anything quite like this. His batting average is .091, and his on-base percentage is .389. So Alex is getting on base. He's just not getting hits. And if that comes around, obviously that's going to help out from that aspect. But, again, the offense has shown the ability to do some things at times here. Martin Maldonado went 3-for-4 at the back end of the lineup last night. He did get thrown out trying to stretch a single into a double. But what I'm saying is that the Royals have, I think, enough offensively right now to keep them in games. I'm not saying they're doing the great things. They're going to score a lot of runs and win a lot of games based on what they're doing offensively right now. But to keep them in games. And when you get in a position to win a game, you got to have a bullpen that's going to close that out for you. And that's going to be the thing that's going to make me nervous about the Royals winning games this year, is can that bullpen, like I say, I mean, I know there's, like Ned said last night, there were some good things that happened. We felt good about what the bullpen did. Well, I felt good about what Willie Peralta and Jake Diekman did. I didn't feel good about what Tim Hill, Ian Kennedy, and Brad Boxberger did. So that's two out of the five guys that you felt good about. What they did, and like I said, I know there's going to be some bloop hits that happen to every pitcher that gets out there, and there's going to be some things. Baseball's not going to bounce your way every time, and I understand that, but right now that's got to be the biggest concern for the Royals, is can that bullpen start to turn things around? Can they find the right formula? Can they find a guy that is that guy that's going to come in and be the closer without question. This is the guy that's going to come in and do it. Like I said, you don't always have to have that, but I think championship teams and teams that are winning games consistently have that guy that they can go to at the end of the game and say, it's over, we're closing it. Greg Holland, Wade Davis, guys like that that we know are going to come in, they're going to close this thing out. Now, I know the Royals don't have that kind of pitcher yet. I'm kind of hoping Ian Kennedy can maybe develop into something like that, and maybe he still will. Maybe Brad Boxberger will get it figured out. Maybe he'll be that guy. Maybe Willie Peralta will end up being that guy at the end of the year and continue to be the closer. But right now that's not defined, and that's something that will need to be defined, I think, if the Royals are going to have success and continue on and try to win more games and maybe surprise some people this year. Right now they're 2-2, the Royals are, after the loss to the Twins last night, 5-4. As they move on today, this afternoon, they finish out this little two-game set with the Twins. That's a 12-15 first pitch. Homer Bailey will make his first start with the Royals, as he, again, came over in the offseason and gets his first outing. And Kyle Gibson gets his first start for the Twins this season. He went 10-13 with a 3.62 ERA last year for Minnesota. And again, Homer Bailey coming in, making his first start for the Royals. 12-15 first pitch this afternoon from Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City. One other note in Major League Baseball, the Atlanta Braves and Ronald Acuna Jr. have agreed to terms on an 8-year, $100 million extension that will keep the star outfielder under contract through the 2026 season. It's a record-setting deal that includes club options for 2027 and 2028. Options are each worth $17 million. The deal includes a $10 million buyout of those option years. Again, Ronald Acuna Jr., 8-year contract extension through the 2026 season for the Atlanta Braves, a young up-and-comer. And I tell you what, Ronald Acuna, $100 million over 8 seasons, if he continues to play the way he is and continues to be a star in the league, then this is what you do. You get these guys locked up early, make it a team-friendly deal instead of having to give somebody $300 million later on down the road. $250, $300 million for a long contract like we're seeing from Bryce Harper and Mike Trout and the likes. You know, this is a good move, I think, for the Braves to be able to lock that in a quick way and get it done and not have to worry about it in the future. So, again, a big move there for the Braves. That wraps up our baseball chat here on the Sports Ticket. And yesterday was a pretty big day as well up north in Nebraska as we shift our attention now to college hoops, where Fred Hoiberg was officially introduced as the next head coach of the Cornhuskers.
Well, welcome, everybody. This is a special and exciting day for the University of Nebraska, and especially for me, because I have the honor and privilege to introduce the 28th head coach of Husker basketball, Fred Hoiberg.
So they're excited there in Lincoln about Fred Hoiberg becoming the new head basketball coach for the Huskers, again taking over for Tim Miles. We've talked a lot about that and probably don't need to cover everything about Nebraska hoops, but I know everybody's looking forward to having Fred Hoiberg. If you're a Husker fan, I haven't talked to him, but I've seen a couple of them, you know, posting on social media. Listen, if you're not excited about the Fred Hoiberg hire, then I don't know what moves the needle for you as a Nebraska Cornhusker fan. I think everybody's got to be pretty excited about Fred Hoiberg coming. Again, spent 5 seasons at Iowa State, and went 115-56 during that time. Had an outstanding record in the Big 12, never finished worse than 11-7, if I remember correctly. Definitely had a great career there at Iowa State before he went on to coach the Chicago Bulls for a time and did not have as much success in the NBA as he has in college, but again, Fred Hoiberg, a great hire for Nebraska, and I said, would have been on Monday, I think, when we first talked about this, that I really feel like, you know, given the right guys that are going to come back and guys that he can recruit and maybe get in, maybe some transfers, I'm going out on a limb and saying Nebraska's going to be in the tournament next year. They had some injuries this year that kind of derailed them. They didn't have a terrible start to this season, but the injuries kind of pulled them back a little bit. And I really feel like that Fred Hoiberg can be the answer to turn it around quick as far as getting to the tournament. They're still a team and a program that has never won an NCAA tournament game. So, I mean, that would be the first thing is obviously to get to the tournament, but the second thing would be to first worry about getting a win in the NCAA tournament before you set your sights any higher than that on maybe making a run in the tournament and a Final Four, national championship might be high aspirations, a little bit too much to think about right now. But I tell you what, Fred Hoiberg, with his track record as a college basketball coach, if he can get the right guys in Lincoln, should be able to do some nice things. And Hoiberg thinks that he has the facilities and the need be and everything that you need to have success there at Nebraska. He's excited about the opportunity, and why not? He's got a chance to get things going and continue on what Tim Miles did to improve the team and continue to make it better.
These facilities are as nice as any in the country, and that's a very attractive thing when you're trying to attract recruits to a market like this, and also the fan support. The fan support is second to none. What I've seen going back, I was a diehard Husker football fan as a kid growing up, and it's just amazing. Every seat in this stadium has been filled since 1962. And then the basketball games, to see the atmosphere. I watched a lot of Big Ten basketball this last year because of Jack and because of Michigan State. And it's just such an unbelievable atmosphere. And I think Tim Miles did a great job and deserves a lot of credit for bringing excitement to this program. And now it's our job to build on that and hopefully become a consistent winner.
I'm Fred Hoiberg. He's talking about Jack. His son, Jack Hoiberg, plays for Michigan State, who made it to the Final Four, so they'll be playing this weekend. I know he was excited about that and mentioned that during his press conference yesterday in his introduction there at Nebraska. What are the expectations there at Nebraska?
I'm excited about this guy.
I guess I don't know if that's the same or not. Hold on.
I'm excited about this, guys. I met with the team just a couple minutes before we came down here, and I talked to them about the opportunity that we have moving forward. And, this is such a special time of year. The greatest sporting event in the world is going on right now with the NCAA tournament. And I challenge them, the amount of work it takes. I was fortunate enough, I played 10 years in the NBA, and I didn't play because I was the most athletic. I didn't play because I was the most gifted. The reason I played is because I was the hardest worker, and nobody was going to outwork me, and that's how I got to that level. And that's what I'm going to demand and expect out of our players, is to go out every day and give everything we can and put an exciting product on the floor that will make our fans proud.
Again, that's kind of the expectation for Fred Hoiberg there at Nebraska. Now, this one's going to be a longer cut, but I think it's interesting just to kind of hear him talk about it and what the job means. Because Nebraska basketball, let's be honest, it's got to be a special person to take that job. He talked in that cut before the last one I played about the fan support and the support behind the football team and growing up a Nebraska football fan. Well, why did he grow up a Nebraska football fan? You're going to hear why. All those things. But listen, basketball, you're going to have to build that. Football was already built. It's established. And Scott Frost comes in and takes that over. And he's a guy that played at Nebraska. He took over the program, and when he played there, had an outstanding program. They were fighting for national championships and won a national championship. So that energy that you get back into the football program is easy to get those fans back and understand, we got Scott Frost. We're going to be heading back toward the top. Maybe they feel like, and like we've said on the station here, we feel like Nebraska will turn things around. They're going to compete for Big Ten championships. And in turn, if you're competing for Big Ten championships, you have a chance to make the college football playoff and compete for national championships. Everybody knows what Nebraska football means historically, especially around here, North Central Kansas, South Central Nebraska. In this area of the country, we know what Nebraska football means. Nebraska basketball does not mean the same thing, not anywhere near the same thing. But Fred Hoiberg's a guy that can appreciate what Nebraska basketball is because he has such deep roots and connection to Nebraska, was born in Lincoln, and had a lot of family that one was a coach for Nebraska basketball, one a professor at Nebraska. You're going to hear him talking about it. And I think I want to play this because it was interesting to me to listen to this and the passion that this guy has, because you've got to have a special person take over a program like Nebraska basketball.
I talked earlier about my grandfather, Jerry Bush. It's such a thrill for me to be able to walk different buildings but on the same sidelines that my grandfather did. And, it's pretty amazing. He probably has the best win in the history of Nebraska basketball. They had lost earlier in the season against a Kansas team led by Wilt Chamberlain, 103-43 is what they got beat. And I asked him before the game, when did you know you were going to lose? He said, when we got out of the bus and Wilt reached across the across the roof and close the door that way. We knew we were going to get beat. So, but then to go back and win that game, and Jimmy Kibaki, who I think was hurt that entire game, they had him go in with about 4 or 5 minutes left, and he went in and hit the game winner. But it was, you know, not very often you shut school down with a basketball win, but they actually did that. That next day they shut class down. And then that following week, to go on and beat Kansas State, team led by Bob Boozer, who was number one team in the nation. So that was, I know, a really fun week for my grandfather and for my family. You know, I didn't get to know him, like I said, very well. He passed away when I was 3 years old. But to hear the stories, Albert Maxey, Albert is here today. He played for my grandfather. Albert has always been great to our family. But I always got letters when I got into coaching, and even when I was playing a little bit in the NBA, from my grandfather's former players, and just to know the impact that he had on their lives. Same thing with professors. I get that, a lot of things from my dad and my other grandfather, Otto. But to hear from my grandpa's players is really cool. And to know the type of person that my grandfather was and the impact that he had in the community here because of the type of personality that he was is always a lot of fun for me to hear.
And Fred Hoiberg there, obviously there's connections, and there's a deep-rooted connection of why a guy like Fred Hoiberg, who has had a lot of success and obviously is well-respected in the especially the college coaching community, that he would come to take a job like Nebraska. So you wonder, why would Fred Hoiberg go to Nebraska? Well, there's all kinds of reasons and all kinds of connections. It was fun and interesting to listen to him talk about that and to be able to follow in his grandpa's footsteps as a head basketball coach there at Nebraska. So, listen, if you're not all in with Nebraska hiring Fred Hoiberg, if you're a Husker fan, I can't help you. This is the best possible hire that Nebraska could have gotten. Bill Moose deserves all the credit in the world, and I realize there's connections and there's reasons that these guys would come back. But to hire Scott Frost in football, to hire Fred Hoiberg in basketball, you've got two of the most prominent young names, too. These are guys that could have long careers, and it sounds like Fred Hoiberg's invested and wants to be at Nebraska. He signed a 7-year, $25 million contract. So if he plays that contract out and then continues to stay 10, 15, 20 years at Nebraska, if they continue to have success, it sounds like he's invested. Now, obviously, you can say all the right things, and then a job comes up like Kansas or North Carolina or Duke, something they really, really want you because, you know, the Blue Bloods are there and one of them's asking for you, and that might change your decision. But right now, it seems like he's pretty set and committed to being the head coach of the Nebraska Cornhusker basketball team. So Nebraska gets the guy they wanted right away. He was the first on the list, and there he is, headed to Lincoln and introduced yesterday to be the next head coach of the Nebraska Cornhuskers. So we'll continue to follow that. A couple other coaching notes. It looks like Buzz Williams is leaving Virginia Tech and will be the new head coach of Texas A&M. Some were wondering, like, why would he leave a Virginia Tech, who was a 4 seed in the tournament, had a pretty good season this year, to go to Texas A&M. Well, Buzz Williams went to school at Texas A&M Kingsville. He's from Texas, and began starting in his coaching career at UT Arlington, if I read that correct. I had that pulled up somewhere, and I don't have that now, but he did start his coaching career in Texas. Buzz Williams obviously had a success as an NCAA coach, and again took Virginia Tech to the tournament this past season. And, yeah, he started at Texas Arlington in 1994 to 98, was Texas A&M Kingsville assistant 98 to 99. So his first head coaching job was at New Orleans. He was an assistant at Texas A&M as well from 2004 to 2006. So very easily to note that as well. So he has spent some time there. His first head coaching job was at New Orleans 2006-2007 season, and then spent a year as an assistant at Marquette. And then from 08 to 14 was a head coach at Marquette, Virginia Tech from 14 to 19. He has a 253 and 155 career record. Again, this past season at Virginia Tech, they went 26-9 before bowing out by 2 in the Sweet 16 against ACC rival Duke. So Buzz Williams headed to Texas Tech. Now, there's also rumors out there, or Texas A&M, not Texas Tech, Chris Beard fully in position, and the coach at Texas Tech who's in the Final Four this weekend. Texas A&M, I've got Virginia Tech and Texas A&M put them together. He's going from Virginia Tech to Texas A&M, Buzz Williams, the new head coach there for the Aggies. There's also rumors out there that Jamie Dixon is finalizing a deal to become the head coach of the UCLA Bruins. Now, this is not at all 100% at this point in time, but they are saying that they're waiting for a buyout, and sources are telling this Gojo Bruin, a verified Twitter account, that UCLA is nearing a deal with Jamie Dixon, pending finalization of his buyout with TCU. So Jamie Dixon, a TCU alum, trying to turn that team around. I really felt like he'd stay there, but looks like UCLA might be a job that he wants, and maybe a challenge that he wants more. We'll find out if that actually comes to fruition. TCU finished their season last night, losing in the semifinals of the NIT to Texas 58-44, which leads us into the finish of the NIT, where the Wichita State Shockers, their run came to a close last night as well. 71-64 loss to Lipscomb. Lipscomb was up 35-30 at halftime. Shockers stormed back. They led by as many as 11 with 6.5 left. They're up by 7 with 3:44 remaining. But Lipscomb went on a 14-0 run to end the game. Got the 7-point win. I was watching this game last night. This Garrison Matthews kid was outstanding for Lipscomb. Had 34 points, had 5 threes. He was creating his own separation. Didn't need a lot of room to knock down those threes, and was clutch from the free throw line, going 11 of 12 as well. And just too much of Garrison Matthews for Lipscomb for Wichita State to handle. So they finished their season at 22-15. Not an outstanding record, but from where they started, what a finish for Wichita State. They won 9 of their last 11 games, and their head coach Greg Marshall kind of reflected on the season afterwards about what he talked about with the kids in the locker room and how much this team meant to him this year.
Some of it was private in our locker room, but I told him I was proud of them. I told him I loved them. I told him I would be there for them the rest of their life. I told him that they were a bridge for what was a very, very bright past and what I hope will be a very, very bright future. And this was a year where we could have taken a big dip. I mean, a big dip. We didn't make the NCAA tournament, but the last 8-9 weeks, playing the likes of Cincinnati twice and at Clemson and at Indiana, Lipscomb, Furman on the road, Temple, amongst others. We went 14 out of the last 18, and we're in Madison Square Garden playing in April. So all I can do is be thankful that I've got these guys as soldiers and just want to see them be successful.
Greg Marshall there, obviously emotional and appreciative of the guys that did things for his squad this year, man. Early in the year, it did not look good for Wichita State. It looked like it was going to be a long season, and really making it into any kind of postseason was thought to be kind of crazy. If you would have talked to him, you know, November, early December, and said, hey, this team's going to make a run to the NIT Final Four, to the NIT Semis, I don't think anybody would actually believe that. And like I said, I know the NIT is not your end goal. It's not what you want to do. It's not what you want to win. You want to make it to the NCAA tournament and play your hand and see how far you can make it there. But the way this team started, and again, 13-13 and winning 9 of their last 11 games, a very impressive finish to the season. And I think it shows a lot of what kind of coach Greg Marshall is and what he can get out of his team. Now, I don't know that Greg Marshall's probably the nicest guy in the world or the best role model to live up to as a coach or anything like that, but I'm going to tell you right now, he gets the best out of his player. You kind of wonder some of the things that all the transfers that happened and people leaving early and thinking maybe they shouldn't have been leaving as early as they did. But, you know, there's questions in that regard. But I don't think you can debate the kind of job he did turning this team around and the way the kids bought in, I'm guessing, to what he was selling and making sure that, hey, the season's not over. We can still do some good things. And, you know, he said get 20 wins and make it to the NIT was the goal. Well, they had 19 wins and going into the NIT, they got their 20th in the first game of the NIT. So, you know, they did what he set out to do, and, you know, they should be committed for that. We'll see what Wichita State does continuing on when they have a little bit more experience going into next year and maybe can get some other guys into the lineup there. So, again, Wichita State finishing their season with a loss last night to Lipscomb. 71-64, the final in that one. And we wrap the sports ticket with this. If you were looking forward to watching the championship game, or if you hadn't seen any of the American Athletic, or Alliance of American Football, I was just talking about Wichita State and the American Athletic, the Alliance of American Football, if you haven't seen any of it, or you know we're going to wait until this weekend to watch the games, well, I'm sorry. You're not going to be able to. The Alliance of American Football has suspended operations immediately. And this is, it's crazy, you know, when you kind of look at some of the things people are saying. But the AAF is not officially folded yet, but they have suspended operations. They said that Tuesday was the last day for players. Wednesday would be the final day for football operations employees in the Alliance. And news comes after a tumultuous day for the startup football league. The term fold was not used. Every indication from Tuesday was that the league's future was in doubt. Controlled by Tom Dundon, the owner of the Carolina Hurricanes, who just in February injected $250 million into the Alliance as a capital investment, $70 million of that coming up front. And CBSSports.com was told that Dundon stands to lose at least $70 million by dissolving the league if and when that happens. So Bill Polian, the head of football for the AAF, was not pleased, and he released a statement. Said, "My thanks go out to all who made our football product so competitive and professional. I'm certain there are many of them destined for future success in the NFL. I look forward to doing all I can to help them in their quest." And he goes on to say, "I sincerely regret that many that believed in this project will see their hopes and efforts unrewarded. They gave their best, for which I am deeply, deeply grateful. Unfortunately, Mr. Dundon has elected this course of action. And extremely disappointed to learn Tom Dundon has decided to suspend all football operations of the Alliance of American Football." So he's not happy about it. Polian, who was the co-founder of the league, it's not, I don't know if it's all about whether they got the people to watch the product or not, but it didn't end well. And at the center of the AAF's uncertain future were the negotiations between the league and the NFLPA over using the use of NFL practice squad players. Last week, Dundon said if a deal could not be reached between the two sides, he'd examine all options, including dissolving the league. In all likelihood, the AAF wouldn't get NFL practice squad players for another couple years because the CBA and the NFL and the massive amount of red tape that would include and require from the NFL to make that agreement official and try to get around everything with the NFLPA and the CBA. So that might have been the sticking point. That was one of the big things where Dundon said, we're not going to be able to do that, then we're not going to do it, and we're not going to have this league anymore. So Dundon's voice is what matters the most there with the future of the AAF, with all the money that he had put into it, and it didn't work out. And just add to the list of spring football leagues that have not worked. You know, the XFL shut down after just one season in operation in 2001. The USFL was the most successful spring league that ran from 1982 to 1986 and actually had some seasons where they got games in and were able to at least have the postseason and crown a champion, which is not even going to happen in the AAF right now. This whole thing has been suspended. Games are shut down. Everything's suspended right now in the AAF. So Steve Spurrier, who was a coach of one of the teams, the Atlanta coach, I believe, actually the Orlando Apollo's coach, and Steve Spurrier bemoaned status of the league on Tuesday after the news broke. He said everybody wanted to play out the season and everybody's disappointed. Everyone's led to believe that the Alliance was well-funded and we could play 3 years without making any money and this, that, and the other. Obviously, everything that was said was not very truthful. When the new owner came in, we thought we had financial backing and we'd be able to at least play out the season. We never thought it would end like this. So that's Steve Spurrier, the head coach of the Orlando Apollo's. Orlando had the best record. They're 7-1. So Steve Spurrier's like, on the other side, we got to be the champs, right? So we finished 7-1. So they were the runaway favorites to win the inaugural championship again, 7-1. But nothing's official. But the team has already said its goodbyes there as far as that's concerned. So, again, the league has not officially folded, but all indications are that it will. And kind of, you know, spring football just doesn't seem to work. It just doesn't seem to be able to do the things that you want to do and try to keep football alive. I think everybody needs that break. I think everybody likes that off season and not being fully invested in one sport for 12 months of the year, because that's basically what it would be. You know, you finish the spring football season and you go into the draft and everything keeps going with training camp after that. So football never ends if you're a fan of it like that. So I think everybody kind of likes that little break. Again, the XFL, like I said, it folded back in 2001, but Vince McMahon has said that he's bringing the XFL back, and that's scheduled to start next spring in 2020. So we'll see if XFL version 2.0 can succeed next season. I'm going to say it's probably not going to be able to. That's a wrap on the Sports Ticket for today. Big thanks for everybody for tuning in today. We'll talk to you again tomorrow on KD Country 94.